Welcome. Thank you for standing by. All participants will be in a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's call. At that time, if you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing star, then one to record your first and last name. Today's conference is being recorded, and if you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to introduce your host for today's call, Mr. Brady Phillips. You may begin.
Thank you, Keisha. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining this monthly climate update call. It's part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to governments, businesses, academia, and the public to help support informed decision-making. Again, my name is Brady Phillips with NOAA's Communications Office in Washington, D.C., and I'll be facilitating the call today. And during the call, we'll feature three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. Today, we will be following along a PowerPoint presentation, and you can get a copy of that online at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings. That's B-R-I-E-F-I-N-G-S. Our first presenter today is Jay Crouch, a climate scientist at the Climate Monitoring Branch in NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information in Asheville, North Carolina. He'll provide us a summary of the March U.S. and Global Climate Reports and the drought monitor released today. Followed by Jake, we'll have Jordan McLeod, a regional climatologist at the Southeast Regional Climate Center located at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And the final presenter will be Dan Collins, a meteorologist and seasonal forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center Operational Prediction Branch in College Park, Maryland, who will provide us the latest El Nino update, as well as the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks for the coming 3 months. We'll begin with Jake from NCEI. Jake?
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to start off speaking to slide number 2 on the deck that you can download from our website. Looking at our global temperature stats for March 2017, this report was released yesterday morning. March 2017 ranked as the second warmest March on record, with a global temperature departure from average of 1.05 degrees Celsius. This is the largest temperature departure from average for any non-El Nino month, and is the first time that a monthly average temperature has exceeded 1 degree Celsius when an El Nino is not present. So the El Nino is not there as it was in 2016, but we're still really warm in terms of global temperatures. Looking at the map on the right, we can see how these temperatures broke down around the globe during the month. Areas in the darkest red were record warm. Notable locations, including the southern U.S., large areas of Siberia, parts of the southeastern Pacific Ocean, parts of the southern Indian Ocean, and parts of Australia were record warm. If you notice as well, there's a record warm dot in the middle of Europe. France, Germany, and Austria all had their warmest March on record. On the cold side of the spectrum, parts of Western Canada, stretching into Alaska, were fairly cold during March 2017, and this is the first time since October 2015 that the Alaskan statewide average temperature was below average. Moving on now to talk to slide number 3. This is a horse race graphic showing year-to-date temperatures as you move from left to right from January through the end of the year. Each line indicates one of our top 10 warmest years. You can see 2016 there at the top of the pack, that was our warmest year on record for the globe. And the darkest black line showing average temperatures January through March for 2017, we can see that the year so far is pretty safely in second place, or second warmest. We do have we're quite a bit warmer than 2015 at this point, but also quite a bit colder than we were in 2016. And that temperature departure from average for January through March was just shy of 1 degree Celsius. Moving on to talk to slide number 4 to look at conditions here in the U.S. during March 2017. The average temperature across the lower 48 was 4.7 degrees above average, and this was the ninth warmest March on record for the lower 48. The map on the left shows how those temperatures broke down across the U.S. If we can see much above average and record warmth spanned much of the Rockies into the Great Plains. Colorado and New Mexico were both record warm for the month. And we did have below average temperatures across parts of the Northeast, and parts of northern New England were also fairly cold during the month of March. Looking at precipitation, it was a near average month across the lower 48, but that averaged out both wet and dry extremes across the country. The Northwest, stretching into the Northern Rockies, parts of the Great Plains, into southern Texas were wetter than average, while we had below average precipitation across southern California, parts of the upper Midwest, as well as the Southeast. Moving on to talk to slide number five, looking at year-to-date temperatures across the contiguous U.S. Looking at temperatures for January through March, this is the second warmest year-to-date for the lower 48, with a temperature 5 degrees above average. The map on the left shows how the temperatures for the first quarter of the year broke down. We can see that most locations from the southwest through the Great Plains and much of the east were much warmer than average, with record warmth scattered across the southern Rockies, southern plains stretching into the southeast. Louisiana, Mississippi, New Mexico, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Texas have all been record warm for the first quarter of 2017. The time series on the right shows January to March temperatures for our period of record dating back 123 years. And we can see that where we are here in 2017, quite a bit above the pack in terms of temperatures for the lower 48, warmer than we were at this point in 2016, but still colder than that record warm year that we saw in 2012 in the lower 48. Moving on to slide number six to speak to the U.S. Drought Monitor report that was released this morning. 8.2% of the contiguous U.S. is in drought, and that's down almost 6 percentage points from late February. So we've seen significant drought improvement across most locations of the U.S., with the exception of the southeast, which continues to have drought impacts. This 8.2% of the U.S. in drought is the lowest drought footprint that we've seen in the lower 48 since August 2010. We did see drought improvement across the west, continuing to see significant drought improvement across California and Nevada. We also saw drought improvement in the Great Plains, parts of the interior southeast, as well as the northeast. We did see drought conditions get worse across parts of the southwest. Also, parts of the southeast where it didn't rain saw drought conditions worsen, and those drought conditions expanded up into the mid-Atlantic. Outside of the contiguous U.S., drought conditions expanded and worsened in Hawaii, with abnormally dry conditions expanding across Alaska, which was fairly dry during the month of March. With that, I will pass it off to Jordan.
All right. Thanks, Jake. Good morning, everyone. So I'll pick up on slide seven, and I'll be talking to you today about a hard freeze that impacted much of the southeast U.S. region back in March. Specifically, it occurred from March 14th through 17th, but for the presentation today, I'll just focus on 2 days where the coldest temperatures were observed and also the spatial coverage of sub-freezing temperatures was maximized. So on this slide, I show two maps, which I acquired from the Southeast Regional Climate Center's Climate Perspectives tool. I provide a link to that at the bottom of the page. But in these maps, I show the observed minimum temperatures that were observed on March 15th on the left and on March 16th on the right. And what you quickly see is that sub-freezing temperatures were on both of these days were observed across much of the region. And then once we move to the 16th, which was really the peak of the freeze, you see that sub-freezing temperatures are now even starting to creep down into portions of northern Florida and the Panhandle. So I'll now turn to slide eight. Exactly how intense was this hard freeze? So again, showed two more maps, very similar to the previous ones that I just talked about, but now I'm showing the departures from average of the observed minimum temperatures on both the 15th and 16th, respectively. And so what you see here is that minimum temperatures were 10 to occasionally, for some stations, more than 20 degrees Fahrenheit below normal across much of the region. A couple of areas within the region were saw departures that were particularly extreme. Portions of South Carolina and southern Georgia, we saw departures around 20 degrees Fahrenheit, in some cases a little bit more than that. And those were the areas that suffered the most extreme agricultural damage, which I'll talk about in a second. One other thing to note is that hard freezes are typically defined as when the air temperature remains at or below 28 degrees Fahrenheit for at least 4 consecutive hours. And so to give you a perspective on some of the stations across the region that observe some of the greatest counts of those consecutive hours, Asheville, North Carolina had 19 hours at or below 28. Roanoke, Virginia had 18 hours. And even places much further to the south, like Valdosta, Georgia, in the south central portion of the state, had 7 hours at or below 28. And Crestview, Florida, in the Panhandle, even saw 5 hours. So, some pretty impressive streaks there. So, moving on to slide 9, I asked the question: was this March freeze unusually late? So, to kind of answer that question, I present this map here provided by NOAA and NCEI that basically shows the average day of the last spring freeze based on the most recent 30-year U.S. climate normals from 1981 to 2010. And so I've shaded or highlighted the southernmost extent of the freeze there across southern Florida, coastal Alabama, and the Florida Panhandle area. And what you see is that these locations, typically their last spring freeze occurs in the two-week range from March 1st through 15th. And so that lines up pretty well, maybe towards the latter end of that range with the freeze that we saw this past March. But basically, this freeze was occurring, you know, right about when we would normally expect, at least for the southernmost portions. If you go further to the north, you notice that their last spring freeze typically occurs a bit later into late March and early April. So nothing unusual in terms of the timing. Moving on to slide 10, what really set the stage for some of the really devastating agricultural impacts that we saw across the region was the warm winter that was observed prior to this freeze. So I show you in the map at the left the mean temperature ranks during meteorological winter, so from basically defined as December 1st through February 28th. And what you quickly notice is that many stations across the region observed their top five warmest winter on record, and some stations even their all-time record warmest winter. And so this persistence of above average temperatures during winter really accelerated the growth cycle of many fruit crops across the region. And, one important factor here as well is that these fruit crops were not able to accumulate enough chill hours during their period of dormancy during the winter when they sort of, recharge before the next spring growing season. And this particularly occurred after we had cold temperatures in early January that did help some. But after that, really from mid-January all the way through February, we did not see nearly enough chill hours for these fruit crops. So they were particularly vulnerable this year to that. And so when we got into sort of the late winter and early spring season, we saw premature budding and blooming of a lot of these fruit crops, even as early as January in some locations. And so this was really detrimental heading into the freeze event. So I'll finish up on slide 11, just kind of summarizing some of the agricultural impacts that were observed. So as I've kind of mentioned, fruit crops were particularly hard hit. We observed at least $1 billion in losses in Georgia and South Carolina alone. Much of this was 90% loss of peaches in South Carolina and an 80% loss of blueberries in southern Georgia. And so the images I show there at the left on the top, a farmer in southern Georgia shows off his part of his blueberry crop that's basically shriveled and dead. And then in the bottom graphic, I show peach blooms in South Carolina that have basically been destroyed by the freeze. Other significant damage that was observed across the region, peaches and pears in Georgia, berry crops in South Carolina, peaches and blueberries in North Carolina, cherries and peaches in Virginia. So you can see the common thread here is fruit crops. But also even in central and northern Florida, some fruit and vegetable crops were affected as well. But not just fruit crops. There were also some damage reports to winter wheat fields. and livestock pastures were set back from their seasonal recovery. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dan.
Thanks, Jordan. Good morning, everyone. I'll begin with the look at ENSO and update you on sea surface temperatures and ENSO. So I'm starting with slide number 12. So looking at the image on the upper left, we're looking at the last 30 days of sea surface temperature anomalies from normal across the globe. And what's noteworthy, you can see a region of above normal sea surface temperatures in the eastern Pacific there off of the western coast of South America. These sea surface temperatures have been rising in the last couple months, January and February and March. You have some significant departures from normal, greater than 2 degrees Celsius above normal in some regions. In the central Pacific, you see an area of blue is an area that's slightly below normal sea surface temperatures, and this is a remnant of the La Nina event that we had over the course of the winter. These temperatures have been rising and approaching the normal average temperatures for that region. Away from the equator, we have above normal temperatures to the north across latitudes from 10 to 30 degrees north across the Pacific. And we also have above normal temperatures across the southern Pacific at similar latitudes. We have above normal temperatures significantly above normal in the range again of 1 to 2 degrees Celsius above normal in the Gulf of Mexico. Overall, we have ENSO neutral conditions present as the La Nina is ended from last winter. Looking ahead towards the ENSO forecast, we're focusing in on the image in the lower left. This shows the probability of either El Nino, which is the presence of warmer than normal sea surface temperatures in the central and eastern Pacific. That is shown as a probability by the red bars. And the green bars show the probability of neutral conditions. This is when the sea surface temperatures averaged across the central and eastern Pacific are within a half a degree Celsius of the long-term averages. La Nina conditions is the blue bars. The probability shown there is the probability that temperatures will be below normal, more than half a degree Celsius below the long-term averages. And so neutral, the current conditions are expected to persist through the spring of 2017. However, the chances of an El Nino event, a warming of the central and eastern Pacific SSTs, approaches 50% by late summer and then continues as 50% or approximately 50% through the autumn into winter. A repeat of La Nina, which is the blue bars there, you can see that that's generally a very small chance that La Nina would return in the coming year. So then I'll move ahead to slide 13. This is showing the monthly forecast for May. On the left is the temperature forecast showing probabilities of above normal in red shades and below normal in blue shades. However, you can see on the map that we actually have no forecast for areas where we have a tilt in the odds towards below normal. In white areas, you see an EC or equal chances. This means that it's equally likely that temperatures would be either above or below or near the long-term normals. So you see elevated chances of above normal temperatures, particularly in the southwestern U.S., across the southern U.S. through Texas into the southeast, and again, elevated probabilities in the southeast, exceeding 50% probability of above normal temperatures, and up the eastern regions of the U.S. You see a tilt in the odds towards above normal. You also see a greater chance of above normal for the state of Alaska. Looking at the map on the right, we are looking at the May precipitation forecast, the probabilities again for above normal here in green or greater than normal precipitation. The probabilities of below normal are in shades of brown. We can see that there's regions of a tilt in the probabilities towards above normal in the northern Rockies extending into the northern plains, across Montana into the Dakotas. And there's also an increased chance of above normal for regions of southern eastern Texas and southern Louisiana. There's an increased chance of below normal precipitation for the month of May in the Midwest and parts of the Great Lakes region. There's also an increase for below average precipitation in the Alaskan Panhandle and parts of northwestern Alaska. From there, I'll move on to the next slide, 14, and take a look at the seasonal forecast for May, June, and July. So on the left, again, probabilities of above normal or below normal temperatures, above normal shown in red. There again aren't any areas in where the likely probabilities indicate a tilt in the odds towards below normal. Generally, across most of the United States, we see an increased chance of above normal temperatures. In the lower 48 states, we see a particularly strong chance above 50% for the season to be above normal in the Southwest. And then again, along the Gulf Coast, we see greater than 50%. And in the case of the season, we see greater than 50% chance of above normal temperatures all the way up the East Coast into New England. We also see a tilt in the odds towards above normal temperatures in Alaska. There's a region where the odds are equal chances of above or below. That is in that area where we saw above normal precipitation from the northern Rockies across Montana and into the Dakotas. So partly related to the precipitation forecast that we saw in the monthly outlook and that you'll see in the outlook for precipitation for the season, and also related to long-term trends, we see equal chances for above or below normal in those regions, but otherwise a tilt in the odds towards above normal across much of the United States. Looking at the map on the right, slide 14, we see the precipitation outlook for the season. This is showing in green, once again, the tilt for above median precipitation or above average precipitation. And in brown shades, we see the tilt in the odds towards below average precipitation. So there's an area where the chances of above average precipitation are increased from New Mexico in the Southwest up through Colorado and into Wyoming and Montana, just east of the Rocky Mountains. This region is related to an expected stream of moisture from the eastern Pacific into the western United States, where, as you saw previously, we have above normal sea surface temperatures in the eastern Pacific. With those above normal sea surface temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico, we also have an area of increased chance of above average precipitation in the western Gulf in areas of Texas and southern Louisiana. And then there in the Midwest, in the western and central Great Lakes regions, we have a tilt in probabilities towards below average precipitation. We also have an increased chance of above average precipitation in eastern interior regions of Alaska. From the seasonal outlook, I'll now take a look at the U.S. drought outlook, which is slide number 15. As was shown previously, we are predicting here a change in the drought going forward from the image that you saw for the current drought in the previous slide. So here we're showing whether we expect that drought will either improve or persist, or in some cases, drought might be removed or might develop in areas where drought isn't already occurring. So most of the map is showing that we have only a small percentage of area covered by drought, as was shown in the previous slide. And in those areas, we can see that drought is expected to persist in areas of California and the Southwest into Arizona. Drought is expected to either be removed or improve in areas of the central United States up through the Great Plains and down into the lower Mississippi Valley. In the Southeast, what you see there is areas where there is already drought are expected to persist, and then there are areas of the Southeast where we expect drought development is likely. So we've had a drying and development of drought in that region, and we expect that will continue going forward. the seasonal outlooks indicate above normal temperatures and at least equal chances of above or below normal precipitation, plus short-term outlooks indicate continued below normal precipitation, so expected development or persistence of drought in the southeast. Otherwise, the conditions for the season indicate that drought is likely to be removed from Florida as well as regions from North Carolina up through Virginia into New England, that drought is expected to be removed. And with that, I'll conclude and turn the call over to Brady.
Thanks, Dan. And now we'll take specific questions from those of you listening. And again, please be sure to clearly indicate who you'd like to answer the question, if at all possible. Operator, can you please remind the participants how they can ask a question and queue up the first question? Thanks.
Thank you. We would now like to begin the question and answer session of today's call. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one to record your first and last name. To withdraw your question, you may press star, then two. Once again, please press star one to record your first and last name. Our first question comes from Brian Sullivan. Your line is open.
Yes. The question I had is you have below average chances for below average precipitation in the Western Great Lakes. I'm wondering, in the drought outlook, I don't see any corresponding possibility for drought in that area. Why is that? And do you think there is possibility that drought may show up there if the forecast comes out, plays out?
Sure. This is Dan. There was some consideration whether, of course, the possibility of below average precipitation for the season would lead to development of drought. However, the odds, the increase in probability is not that great. So there's, of course, this is not a definitive forecast, and so it's not terribly confident. And in addition to that, I think climatologically there's significant precipitation in that region at this time of year. So there can be a difference depending on the climatology of precipitation. What's the expected precipitation if it were, say, near average in that region? Also, it's of note perhaps that the temperature forecast is not, as strong a tilt in the probabilities towards above normal temperatures as it is, say, in the southeast.
Mm-hmm.
So in that region of the Great Lakes, it's not considered as strong a tilt towards positive anomalies. And also it makes significant positive temperature anomalies through the season not quite as likely as they are where the probabilities are tilted higher.
Thanks.
Oh, operator, can you remind folks again how to queue up a call or how they can ask a question? Oh, operator? So if you do have a question, please press star one. And at the moment, I don't see any in the queue.
I do apologize. We had some technical difficulties. One moment, please. Our next call comes from Patricia Kitchen. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks very much. I'm wondering, Dan, if you could just speak to So a tilt towards above normal for May, and then May into July for the East Coast. We're especially interested in New York and especially interested in the Long Island section of New York. So I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the factors that lead to this, to your, you know, to that indicate that it will be or is expected to be a little bit above normal.
Sure. This is Dan with DPC, and as you indicated correctly, both the May outlook for temperature and the May, June, July period have a tilt in the odds towards above normal temperatures, especially so in the May, June, July period, exceeding 50%. So in respect to the factors related to this, there's several. First, we do have long-term trends that would tilt the odds towards above normal. That means that in the recent decades, we've had greater temperatures during this season than in previous decades during this season, mm-hmm. as you saw previously in the description of the temperatures over the United States. This has also been the case in the recent seasons leading up to mm-hmm. May, July. As well, we also have, looking at dynamical model forecasts, which we use for making these seasonal outlooks. It appears that several of the models are tilting towards increased high pressure over the eastern United States. That also plays into the possibility of below average precipitation more in the Midwest. But over the eastern United States, the potential for relatively high pressure during the season would lead to above normal temperatures as well.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
The next question comes from Mitchell Roffer. Your line is open.
Thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed this presentation. I'm looking at slide 5, and I deal with a lot of people who are skeptical of such graphs. So particularly one showing the temperature from 1890 to 2010 plus. The question I often get when I show this to people is that what is the effect of the urbanization of the temperature gauges from 1890 to the present, and is that influencing these increase in temperatures?
This is Jake. So this analysis of contiguous U.S. temperatures, we're looking at over 3,000 stations across the lower 48. That's a mix of both urban stations and rural stations. And in our analysis, when we aggregate across aggregate up to state level or national level, we do take into account the urban heat islands. So that is a factor in this analysis. Urban areas are warming. Rural areas are also warming. The warming is not uniform, but all areas are warming across the lower 48, and that does show up when we average temperatures for the contiguous U.S. and compare to values in the past.
Okay, thank you.
The next question comes from Brian Sullivan. Your line is open.
Hey, Jake, I just wanted to ask you, if an El Nino does show up later on this year, what are the probability that 2017 will make a run for the record?
Yep, this is Jake. Looking at slide number 3, the horse race graphic kind of shows how the El Nino could impact global temperature. So the line there for 2015, that year was marked by an El Nino at the end of the year. So that's the third line from the top, and you can mm-hmm. see how the El Nino at the end of the year kind of influenced the global temperature by ramping up the temperature at the end of the year. 2016, the year started with the El Nino, and the El Nino waned. So we can see how the first part of 2016, we have warming temperature departures from average, and then as the El Nino waned, the global temperature also dropped somewhat. We can see here in early 2017, we do have an upper trajectory in terms of the global temperature anomaly. And if we do have an El Nino, we would expect the 2017 temperature departure from average to warm somewhat as we continue through the year or even persist. And if we see that value for January through March of 0.97 degrees Celsius, if that temperature departure from average persisted throughout the rest of the year, 2017 would surpass 2016. So there is a possibility that 2017 will be warmer than 2016. And if the El Nino does develop, and depending on its intensity, we could surpass the record again this year.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
As a reminder, to ask a question, please press star 1 to record your first and last name. One moment to see if we gather questions.
Okay, this is Brady. Last call for questions. I'll give it 10 seconds. Otherwise, I'll close it out. Okay, so I will close out again. Thank you to all of our speakers for their time and to everyone else for participating in the call. I'll end by giving you a few reminders of some upcoming releases in the month of May. So the April U.S. Climate Highlights will be released on May 8th. The April Global Climate Highlights will be released on May 18th. And we'll also have our next monthly climate call on May 18th as well. And finally, on May 25th, NOAA will issue its 2017 Hurricane Outlook at a media event likely in the Washington, D.C. area. A separate media advisory will be sent out for that. In the meantime, if you do have further questions, please email me, brady.phillips@noaa.gov, or my colleague, John Leslie, that's john.leslie@noaa.gov, and we'll get back to you as soon as we can. This concludes the call. Thank you. Goodbye.
This concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time. Okay.